Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, your intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. My name is Fred Flight, Senior Vice President with the Center for Security Policy, substituting for your normal host, Frank Gaffney. My first guest today is someone who I admire a great deal and consider a friend, Diana West. She's a nationally syndicated columnist. She blogs at dianawest.com, and she is such an expert on so many national security subjects, including the Soviet Union and Russia. Diana, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Fred. It's wonderful to be with you.
Well, Diana, you've been writing on your blog site about this dodgy dossier that's been used to justify spying on Trump campaign officials, as well as the whole Russia investigation. But you touched on something in a February 3rd blog post that I thought was especially interesting. And that is an individual named John Brennan, a former CIA director. Now, I'd like to hear your take on this, and I'd like you to fold in something I find very odd, that at a time that we're hearing that the Russia investigation supposedly was started by the FBI because of George Papadopoulos saying something in a bar when he was drinking, at the very same time in mid-2016, John Brennan was trying to get a Russia investigation rolling. Now, is it a coincidence that these two developments were happening at the same time?
There are an awful lot of coincidences in this story, aren't there, Fred? We don't know. We don't know. There's so much that's still hidden from us, but we are picking up on the clues. And we know that the Christopher Steele so-called dossier started floating around with in installments starting in June of 2016. We also found out, and this was something I went back to, Lee Smith has also noted this, that the Washington Post told us earlier in 2017 that John Brennan made a tremendously unusual submission to the White House, very hush-hush, eyes only, special courier, in early August of 2016. He sent an envelope over, and it was, yes, it was a Russian bombshell, as described in the Post. It was supposed to come from sources deep in the Kremlin, and it was supposed to be showing that Donald Trump and his organization were compromised by their relationships with Russia. And when I went back to this piece, which is over 6, 7, 8 months old now, I went back to it because it suddenly occurred to me that maybe what John Brennan had couriered over to the White House at this time was, in fact, the first 2-3 installments of the Steele dossier. And this would be quite sensational if we could run this down, because just as the FBI and the Justice Department were relying mostly on this same Steele dossier, unvetted, etc., it could be that the entire, quote, intelligence community was also relying on this same unvetted information to kickstart their own parallel information war, really, on the Trump campaign that we would see first coming out in October, right before the election, assessing the idea that the Trump campaign had been, that the election was being interfered with by the Russians, and then later that this was interference was a matter of collusion with the Trump campaign. So this becomes a very important issue because it could be that the Steele dossier is the basis, the mainstay of the entire narrative that has been weaponized against Trump, not just from FBI and Justice, but also from NSA, CIA, etc. We don't know that yet. I'd love to see Brennan questioned about this under oath.
This is such an important revelation because I just don't believe in coincidences in national security. And I suspect that everybody in the Obama and Clinton orbit were all working together to promote this Russia narrative. And it's just too coincidental that Brennan was going to the says he went to the FBI at the same time we know other people going to the FBI. I just don't think it's credible that they were going there separately. Now, you also said that this information that Brennan provided was not mentioned in the PDB, the Presidential Daily Brief?
Right. That was the story. This was supposed to be a very compartmentalized vector of information. It only was supposed to go to, I believe, four people, Obama and three senior officials. What happened after that, we also see a series of briefings that start going to the Congress, the so-called Gang of Eight. You start wondering if indeed these briefings are based again on this same dossier that was just circulating all over Washington, including to the media, as we now find out. And this becomes the basis of a criminal referral on Christopher Steele that Senators Graham and Grassley have presented to the Justice Department. Very interestingly, those two senators also have referenced John Brennan on their recent batch of letters to DNC and Hillary campaign officials asking whether they were communicating about the Steele dossier to about 40 people and entities, including John Brennan, which is very interesting to find Brennan on the Judiciary Senate Judiciary Committee's radar, because this, you know, he sort of seemed to sneak away from the entire conflagration that we've been living in. And yet the senators are now asking whether DNC and Hillary campaign were discussing the dossier with John Brennan and these others. And I think that that is a very important question for us to figure out, you know, what was really going on. We are looking at, you know, the old-fashioned phrase, the web of subversion that was discussed, that was presented as a way to understand what was going on in Washington in terms of Soviet infiltration and communist infiltration and fellow travelers. We are looking at, when you look at that list of 40 people and entities presented by Senators Graham and Grassley, you have to think web of subversion, because you're looking at what seems to be a government-wide secret conspiracy to subvert the democratic process. That is by definition subversion. And you're looking at actors that cross the government, not just DOJ and FBI. Now we're also the senators are referencing the State Department, which just now is kind of entering the mix of what was going on through a State Department official with a longtime John Kerry associate named Jonathan Viner, who seems to have been a vector of the dossier to John Kerry, and also a vector of Clinton associate input. This would be the second anti-Trump file that Steele also gave to the FBI. This is a relatively new piece of the story. Jonathan Viner was involved in that, it seems to be, going between Sidney Blumenthal, Cody Shearer, Jonathan Viner to Christopher Steele to the FBI, as he was also involved going taking the Steele dossier in memo form to John Kerry. So he's sort of a incoming and outcoming link here. So this is not just the Justice Department. Now we're looking at the State Department. Now we're looking at the FBI. I mean, we are looking at a web of subversion that must be aired. Everything needs to come out, all the documents. This is such a crucial moment where we have an opportunity to find out what was happening, what these people were doing to suborn our system.
Well, quickly, concerning Brennan, I don't think there's anyone more hostile towards Donald Trump in the public sphere. And he's trying to claim that this information from the Steele dossier wasn't used at all in intelligence analysis, which we know isn't true because it was sent to the U.S. intelligence community through British channels. What's Brennan's problem? What's the issue with him?
Well, I think he's in full cover-up mode. I think he'll say anything and do anything to cover this up, because if we discover that the intelligence community assessment was based on the Steele dossier, I mean, that just blows up everyone. I mean, that becomes, you know, the scandal just goes to an exponential new level of collusion, of subversion, of you know, disloyalty to the Constitution. I mean, we've already got a conflagration. We've already have a huge scandal. It would increase it tenfold. So that is where he is. I think it's pretty clear, and that's why it's very important to find out from him and his associates what was the truth, and this really becomes a burning issue.
Well, Diana, we have to stop it there. Diana West, thank you so much for your excellent analysis of this very difficult subject. My next guest will be Kevin Freeman, who will be discussing some information concerning recent volatility in the U.S. stock market. My name is Fred Fleischer, Secure Freedom Radio. Stay tuned.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm Fred Fleitz. My next guest is Kevin Freeman. He is author of Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack, and Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again. He is founder of GlobalEconomicWarfare.com and a senior fellow with my organization, the Center for Security Policy. Kevin Freeman, welcome.
Thank you, Fred. Good to be here.
Well, Kevin, look, you are an economic and financial expert, and I think everybody listening wants to hear your take on the recent stock market volatility before we get into other issues.
Sure. Well, as everybody knows, on Friday there was a 666-point down day in the Dow, and that seemed bad enough. But on Monday, the market gyrated and ended up down almost 1,600 points at one point and closed it down 1,175 points. And then yesterday we had a rebound and the Dow gained back 565 points or so. It's a roller coaster, and people are scared and wondering what's changed.
So is there anything we should be worried about here, any malevolent factors or some type of issue that you could point to?
Well, there are three possible explanations for what happened. It's a normal correction, and Occam's razor would tell us that's probably the most simple and therefore most likely explanation. But I think we need to look further. There's two other explanations that have surfaced that are being discussed. What happened is there was a very obscure volatility derivative instrument, and most people have never heard of it. Most people have never heard of the VIX, let alone the XIV, which is a double short exchange-traded product that was designed, you know, we'll bet and make sure the stock market stays flat and normal. The average investor never hears of these products. They don't know anything. They buy a stock. They think Apple is a good stock. I'll buy it and I'll hold it. But on Wall Street, there's all these derivative games where people are making bets on whether or not it's going to be more volatile or less volatile, or if a stock will go to a certain level before a certain date. But there are all these instruments we were talking about that can be manipulated by foreign governments, as they did in the year 2008, or by big traders, hedge fund players. People look to what George Soros did to the United Kingdom. The timing of this current drop is very suspicious because it comes on the heels of improving poll numbers for the president. It comes on the heels of a good State of the Union address that was well received, good economic numbers and so forth. And so some have argued that the political operatives don't want to see the president look successful, and he keeps pointing to the stock market. And so they thought they'd shake it up. And they may have done that. It's possible. I'm not saying that they did. Using an obscure instrument called the XIV, and where they made one of these crazy little bets on whether the market would be more or less volatile. These sorts of instruments were the very things that two Russian spies that were caught back in a few years ago in 2015 by the FBI. They listened in on conversations that they had using proper wiretapping back to Russia, and these two spies, Justice Department brought charges. They were looking for ways to find little obscure things in the exchange traded markets like the ETFs or ETNs that they could use to manipulate. And so what I've written recently in globaleconomicwarfare.com, which is my blog, is we're seeing lots of signs, the winds of war, and it may be possible that China, Russia, or others were weapons testing. Can we bring the stock market down? Can we make it go down at will? And that is what we saw in a flash crash, and it may have been what we've seen this week.
Well, indeed, you said in a recent blog posting that the scent of the next world war already is in the air, and that this next world war will be cyber economic in nature, and that it is in its early stages. Can you expound on that?
Yeah, we've actually been in an economic war since the mid-1990s, when the Chinese started stealing technology and really manipulating in our government. They've been lobbying and so forth. It ramped up and hit took a nasty turn when the Al-Qaeda attacked us and attacked the World Trade Centers. And it got worse in 2008 when they almost took down the global financial system. China, Russia, and others have decided that U.S. Leadership in the financial markets is something that they cannot no longer accept. They've been very public about this, but they've also behind the scenes been doing all kinds of things to dethrone the dollar as the reserve currency, to impact our stock markets and so forth. These are the things that I'm most worried about. We see hacking and flash crashes and so forth. And what we might have seen on Monday was could have been a weapons test. Do we have the ability to affect stock market investors? How do people react to it? So that's what I'm worried about.
Now, let's look at the stock market volatility from a different angle. The Wall Street Journal ran an editorial on February 5th titled "The Return to Normal Risk," in which they argued that growth in the stock market during the Obama years was in large part manipulated by the Federal Reserve, and that this was actually unhealthy, that the market has to undergo occasional corrections. Do you subscribe to this view?
Absolutely. And Occam's razor will tell us that is probably what happened. It is a return to normalcy. My point isn't that normalcy it doesn't include these volatile markets. It should. We should see corrections. That's a normal and healthy part. My point is that it's at those points that the corrections can be manipulated using these complex financial instruments, and that's what I'm worried about.
Is it plausible that billionaire opponents of President Trump, like George Soros, could collaborate to somehow affect the stock market to either hurt Mr. Trump or to affect the 2018 congressional elections?
It's not only plausible, it's likely. But again, the market has to be cooperative. If the market isn't cooperative, those measures won't work. But right now, the return to normalcy, the Fed pulling back, that is a time in which you could pull those stunts.
But you're saying that these derivatives, these special types of funds that give malevolent actors leverage over the stock market, they seem to be a vulnerability. Is this something there should be more regulation or oversight of to prevent individuals from manipulating the stock market?
No, absolutely. These products get ridiculously silly. For example, this XIV, it was an $8 billion volatility bet that was mentioned, and I think it was a Wall Street Journal, called an $8 billion volatility bet. If you can use $8 billion, which is a small amount of money in the global scheme of things for major players, and you can cause that level of trillion-dollar disruption, there needs to be some level of regulation. These are bets. It's gambling, in a sense.
So tell us about your next analysis. Where are you now that the stock market's coming back, what are you looking at now?
What I'm most concerned about now is the fact that interest rates are rising. We have a $20 trillion debt, and if we're borrowing money at 1%, we pay $200 billion a year in interest as a government. If interest rates go to 5%, then we pay $1 trillion. This is an enormous amount of money that our government is on the hook for, and it affects defense spending. It affects the ability for people to pay their mortgages and so forth. So what I'm most concerned about is Russia's and China's plan to dethrone the dollar, and what the impact would have would be skyrocketing interest rates, which would cause us to fall and collapse like a Zimbabwe or a Venezuela. So I call that phase three of the economic war, and I think that's what we ought to be preparing for.
Well, Kevin Freeman, we have to stop there. Thank you so much for your analysis. This is Fred Flight substituting for Frank Affney on Secure Freedom Radio. Next up, Dr. Bruce Bechtol will be discussing the North Korean threat. Stay tuned.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Fred Flight substituting for Frank Gaffney. My next guest is Dr. Bruce Bechtol. He is professor of political science at Angelo State University. He's a member of the editorial advisory board of the Korea Observer, a member of the board of directors of the U.S. Council on U.S.-Korea Security Studies, and president of the International Council on Korea Studies. Dr. Bechtol, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get into the recent developments concerning North Korea, I understand you have a book forthcoming. Could you talk a little bit about it?
I do. This is the culmination of a four-year project. I got a very large research grant to study North Korean proliferation in the Middle East and Africa. So my book is actually called North Korean Military Proliferation to the Middle East and Africa, Enabling Instability and Violence is the subtitle. And the book is pretty simple, but it's a methodology nobody's used before. I am of the assessment that you can't really understand the impact of military proliferation to any region or country unless you understand what's going there. So I take a whole chapter and look at all the various weapon systems that North Korea has, what they're capable, some of the capabilities that North Korea proliferates, like their special operations forces, et cetera. Then I take another chapter and I look at exactly how they get around sanctions, what their modus operandi is for proliferating their weapons around the world when there's so many sanctions surrounding them, basically explaining how North Korea's overseas activities work much like a mafia family. And then I get down to exactly who they're proliferating to. So there's a chapter on North Korean proliferation to Syria. There's one on proliferation to Iran, and then a whole chapter on proliferation to the continent of Africa. And then, of course, I wrap up with saying how we can contain or end this proliferation that gets North Korea $3 to $4 billion a year and really helps them survive. So this ends this summer when the book actually comes out, and I just looked at the proofs yesterday, actually.
Well, I look forward to seeing it. There was recently a UN report that North Korea made $200 million in sanctions violations in 2016 and 2017. A German intelligence agency said that North Korea has been covertly acquiring missile, nuclear, and chemical technology through the Berlin embassy. There's been reports of offshore oil transfers in violation of UN sanctions recently. So I'm wondering, is this situation getting worse, and can we get sanctions to work against North Korea?
Well, that's a very good question. That's the question. And the $200 million is actually just basically non-military proliferation activities. So, I mean, it was mostly talking about the oil that they were selling. North Korea actually makes several billion a year in illicit activities. So, I mean, this has really stepped up for the North Koreans for several reasons. In other words, the answer to your question is yes. They have had a rough spot in their relationship with China. Things with them are not working as well as they have, particularly economically. They no longer get all of the aid from South Korea that they got up till about 10 years ago. And, of course, sanctions have gone after a lot of their legitimate overseas endeavors, such as they are, largely oil. So, yes, proliferation and other illicit activities, such as illegal drugs, counterfeit currency, even the selling of exotic animals and things like that, has gotten to be much bigger in the latter years of the Kim Jong-il administration, and it's really exploded in the Kim Jong-un administration. And there's been other factors as well, such as, you know, Iran's hunger for ballistic missiles and a nuclear program, and the fact that the Syrian government needs so many weapon systems because it's involved in a civil war. So all of that's come together for kind of a perfect storm that's become quite profitable in an illicit way for the DPRK.
You know, many people who we both know who cover the North Korea issue believe that China has been facilitating its nuclear and missile program. However, there were two academics, Chinese academics, who published articles in late 2017 questioning China's relationship with North Korea, suggesting that North Korea may be a latent enemy, and suggesting that China may have to start thinking about contingency plans for a post-conflict North Korea. Do you think there's any chance China is reconsidering its North Korea policy?
Well, I did a war game with some Chinese scholars last fall, the fall of 2017, early fall in September. I think China is, at least if one is to judge those individuals, they were all Chinese scholars. China is uncomfortable with North Korea's rogue state behavior, and yet the Chinese consider that North Korea is sort of their problem and nobody else's. You know what I'm saying? So because of that, the Chinese continue to look the other way. Maybe not the Chinese government directly, but a lot of Chinese corporations with close ties to the government have sold the North Koreans things like, tractor trailers that are used for missile launchers, et cetera. And the economic flow of a variety of types of goods continues to flow across the border into China and through their ports. So, you know, if China was really serious, the government of China, about clamping down on North Korea's illicit financial activities and their proliferation, they could be much more proactive in doing it than they are. Even today, much of what they do seems like basically a token.
My friend, Asian expert Gordon Chang, who I'm sure you know, has taken issue with the idea that the Trump administration reportedly is considering of a bloody nose strategy. That would be a limited military attack on North Korea, maybe a naval blockade, maybe shooting down missiles to try to send a message to North Korea that we're serious without starting a war. Well, Chang thinks it would start a war, and this is a serious mistake. What's your take on this?
Well, Gordon Chang's a very good friend of mine, and I think he's a very smart man. There's a difference between shooting down a missile that's going to be overflying Japan or blockading a port, although I think blockading a port is considered an act of war. And it probably wouldn't do any good anyway because it doesn't do anything about the Chinese border. You see what I'm saying? But I think that this preemptive strike, this bloody nose that we've heard rumors about, I think that the problem with that is misinterpretation or escalation. And please allow me to explain that. The North Koreans could easily misinterpret us taking out a missile on its pad, in other words, attacking an actual North Korean military unit, as the first strike in what's going to be a war, right? Or, even if they understand what we're doing, that we're not going to engage in a full-scale war, as has happened in brinkmanship and provocations with its neighbor to the south, things could start to escalate, get out of hand, and the next thing you know, there's North Korean artillery firing rounds into Seoul, and we've got ourselves into a full force-on-force conflict. So I think this is something that we need to be very, very careful about. If you were to ask me, and nobody has, nobody in the government has asked me for advice on this, but my advice would be the only time we should actually engage in an act of war against North Korea is if they make the first move, because that's consistent with our values as Americans. Now, that said, I don't think there's anything wrong with, for example, if North Korea does a missile test, for example, and they shoot off what they called the Hwasong 15 and it overflies Japan, for example, or they shoot a missile towards Guam, as they've done once now. I don't think there's anything wrong with using our ballistic missile defense to take that thing out of the sky, because that shows them that we do not fear that threat that they're trying to convey to us. The problem with that is our ballistic missile defense ready to do that? How accurate will it be?
Well, Dr. Bechtel, I think that is a big question, but I'm afraid that we have to run. Thank you so much for your analysis. I look forward to your forthcoming book. This is Fred Flight substituting for Frank Affney on Secure Freedom Radio. My next guest is Arthur Millick, an associate director with the Heritage Foundation. Please stay tuned.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. My name is Fred Flight, substituting for Frank Gaffney. My next guest is Arthur Millick, Associate Director of the Heritage Foundation's B. Kenneth Simon Center for Principles and Politics. He has written for the Daily Signal, National Review, and NationalAffairs.com. He also previously worked with the House Armed Services Committee. Arthur, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You've written something interesting recently called Civility and Rebarbarization. And I got to tell you that civility is something there is quite a lack of in this town right now, with both Republicans and Democrats accusing each other of treason, and Democrats saying all sorts of unbelievably negative things about the president and the Republicans. So tell us about your article and how we might think about it in terms of what's going on in Washington right now.
Sure. So we often use this word today, civility, and the opposite of which is incivility. And they sort of mean politeness and not politeness. In other words, can we, in a kind of superficial way, get along with one another? So that's sort of the public context of what we mean. But this word has a deeper meaning. And it is part of a tradition of political philosophy that has thought through what kind of a human being is suited to be ruled by laws. And that kind of human being is civilized. He possesses civility. And the opposite of civility is barbarism. That is a human being, according to this, again, very long tradition of political philosophy, that is not suited to be ruled by laws. And so when we talk about civility in the sort of DC context, I think we slightly miss the mark. Civility as a concept is a sort of a civilizational level concept, and not just about getting along. When we say civility and incivility, we're talking about really kind of partisan politics. Can we find a compromise? Do we get very angry with one another? But beneath it is this deeper concept, as I'm saying.
Well, I got to tell you, having worked in Washington for 25 years, my experience with the idea of civility and compromise usually means that Republicans doing what the Democrats want. That for Democrats, civility means going along with them. And I've just seen this over and over again. And that whenever Republicans challenge the foreign policy establishment, they're accused of being incivil and of upsetting the political arrangement in Washington that keeps things running. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that's true. And that sort of broadly points, I think, to the net gains and losses that one can calculate of the right versus the left over the past 40 years. I think that basically the right continues year by year, inch by inch, to cede ground to the left, and we always lose the moral high ground. We are constantly deformed by political correctness. We are incapable of really stating our position, and we only can state our position or what's good for the country once it's almost too late. I think immigration is basically the best example of that. Nobody had talked about this in any kind of real or forceful way in terms of how immigration can transform a culture, can change a nation in terms of the problems of sovereignty and the rule of law. Nobody really talked about this in any strong way over the past 20 years until basically the last 12 months or so. And the reason is because conservatives, Republicans, had been deformed year after year, on the one hand by the kind of oligarchic rule of the Republican Party and their desire for cheap labor, but really, on the other hand, a genuine fear of the left in being called a xenophobe, a racist, being clamped down generally by political correctness. And so that's the partial explanation of why we cede inch by inch, year after year, so much ground.
You know, I really see this on Capitol Hill. There's this effort to be bipartisan, to have congressional reports that have no dissenting view, to basically have some type of consensus. And I got to tell you, time after time, every time these consensus reports are put out, it seems that the conservative views have been crossed out. And what's left is, frankly, pablum dictated by country club, middle-of-the-road Republicans and the Democrats, who gave up nothing.
Right. It's always the safe position, and it's almost always the case that the safe position is incoherent with the common good, or a kind of what would be gained by gaming out the next 50 or 60 years of what it would take to sustain our republic. And the reason is because, look, at one point, the Senate was designed to be totally liberated from public opinion. They would be indirectly elected, and the cause of that was to maintain a kind of aristocratic element in our regime that is insulated from day-to-day passions. The trouble is, today, there's no such thing anymore, not just in the Senate, but anywhere. Everything is controlled by public opinion. Everything is dependent on public opinion. And therefore, the question comes in, you know, where in our nation, where in the federal government, is there a unassailably strong element that is free to think about the common good and to act strongly on it? And there isn't such a thing. And because the general trend in liberal democracy is toward more liberalism, towards softening and weakening, towards more of a kind of the rule of the tastes of the public governed by a kind of new elite, where would there be opposition to any of the things that you mentioned? And so it's this kind of slow, gradual creep, because there's no longer really an institution to oppose it.
You know, in my view, civility in D.C. is in some ways a straitjacket on conservative thinkers who want to think outside the box. And Donald Trump, and I think now Devin Nunes, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, I think they have taken a different approach. They're throwing this to the winds because they think that their position basically is being blocked out by the mainstream media and the foreign policy establishment and basically the people in Washington who push this political correctness. Do you see Trump and Nunes as challenging this system?
Totally. This is Nunes is a smaller character in this drama, but just to focus on Trump for a second, this is clearly a rebellion against, I mean, we use this word establishment. It's not clear what it means. It means a lot of things, but one way to characterize it is a kind of trans-party elite unity that is often in conflict with the interests of the American public. And that the Trump phenomena is a rebellion against that. There's no question about it. The problem with these kinds of rebellions is that they happened when it's either too late or almost too late. And that's why they're always so dramatic. That's why Trump, at every step he makes, in the most smallest of steps he makes, there's always this kind of fanatical opposition to him. And the partial reason for that is that these elites who have ruled for the past 30, 40, maybe 50 years so soundly without any kind of interruption, have lived sort of luxuriant, unopposed lives, have never had a genuine opposition to them. As you said, everybody just kind of agrees behind closed doors. And when these reports come out, the result is a kind of neutral non-opinion. And so the reason that the Trump revolution is so strong and so obvious to all eyes is that there has been a new unification of middle of America who has felt oppressed for a very long time, who has not had any kind of institutional support or genuine representation of their opinion, of what they feel, and now has a kind of unity between the executive and themselves. And it comes out so strongly, so loudly, even so vulgarly to some degree, because it has been oppressed for so long.
Well, Arthur, I'm afraid we have to stop there, but this really was a fascinating conversation, and it touches on so many frustrations I've seen through my career in Washington over conservatives giving up their values. So I'd like to thank you very much for coming on our program today. This is Fred Flight, substituting for Frank Gaffney on Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll tune in tomorrow.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.